Hello and welcome to Crosstalk, where all things are considered. I'm Peter Lavelle. American investor David Sacks says the Ukraine conflict is based on falsehoods and deceit about how it started, how it's going, and how it will end. On this edition of the program, we examine all three propositions. Crosstalking Ukraine, I'm joined by my guest, Dan Kovalik in Pittsburgh. He is a professor of law and author of The Plot to Scapegoat Russia. In Salt Lake City, we have David Pine. He is deputy director of national operations for the Task Force on National and Homeland Security. And in Bali, we cross to Carl Zhao. He is a political analyst, historian, and host of the Silk and Steel podcast. All right, gentlemen, Crosstalk rules in effect. That means you can jump anytime you want, and I always appreciate it. I'm going to go first to Dan. I mean, I really liked how the investor, Mr. Sacks, broke it down into three parts. So let's look at the first one. How did the conflict start in Ukraine? Because he's saying that Western media is purveying lies, falsehood, and deceit. Go ahead, Dan.
Yeah, well, first of all, as you know, I've been to the Donbass twice in the last year, and really a lot of it centers around there, that the conflict really began in 2014 with the coup against a democratically elected government in Kiev, a coup that the U.S. backed. A right-wing government came to power, which was very hostile towards its Russian ethnic and speaking populations, particularly in the east, particularly in the Donbass. And when the Donbass, Donetsk and Luhansk became alarmed about where the country was headed, they declared their independence from Kiev with a referendum, and Kiev began to shell and attack.
Yeah, but Dan, I thought it all started one morning in February of 2022 that Russia suddenly attacked Ukraine. That's the narrative that we get in the West.
But it's not a true narrative. Already by then, 14,000 people had died in that conflict between Kiev and the Donbass. And Russia's intelligence was that Kiev was preparing for an invasion, a ground invasion of the Donbass. And Russia decided it could not allow that.
Okay, we have that from the OSCE. You don't even need that from Russian sources. David in Salt Lake City, I mean, when we look at the origins of the conflict, very little is said about how the Ukrainian military had been NATO-ized, where you had NATO advisors, reconnaissance. I mean, everything you need for a modern army was being pumped in there at a furious rate. That's never mentioned in the narrative, is it, David?
No, it's not. We had about 1,000 NATO troops, including, you know, of course, that's not counting CIA operatives, training the Ukrainian military. We were training them at the rate of 10,000 a year. We had 80,000 NATO-trained troops in the Ukrainian army that formed kind of the elite forces of the Ukrainian army. And we had joint military exercises with between NATO and Ukraine, inside of Ukraine and Western Ukraine. And then finally, we had Biden signed a strategic partnership agreement between the U.S. and Ukraine, which, of course, was aimed against Russia. And all these were unnecessary provocations, as was just stated. You know, this conflict really began with the 2014 coup that was authorized by then Vice President Biden. Biden really is the common denominator in starting this war, and that's why I've long been referring to this war as Biden's war rather than Putin's
well,
war.
Well, before it was Biden, it was Victoria Nuland's war. That's what I kept calling it back in 2014. Let's, Carl, in Bali, another issue that is not mentioned is that in December 2021, before the conflict in February 2022, Russia basically sent out its term, saying, we want to avoid a conflict here, but we will react through military and technical means. And that was completely ignored. Again, not part of the narrative. Carl.
Exactly. Like President Putin pointed out during his Tucker Carlson interview, Kamala Harris actually went to Europe and publicly announced that Ukraine should be welcomed into NATO. I mean, 2014 is when the war broke out, but it's really a culmination of the steady NATO expansion eastward since 1992, which is really, I mean, it's, the whole purpose was to justify the continued existence of NATO after Cold War. You know, NATO was formed against Soviet Union collapsed, Russia wanted to be friends with the West, but all the NATO bureaucrats realized, wait a minute, they're going to be out of jobs. So it's all about jobs.
It's all about jobs, and it's about money and hubris, I would say. Okay, Dan, let's take a look at the second question. How is the war going? Well, according to the Munich Security Conference that ended last week, everything is basically on course. It's tough, you know, tough times ahead and all that. But Russia is losing. Ukraine is winning. Again, what's wrong with that narrative? Dan.
Yeah, no, Russia has steadily gained ground in this war very methodically and slowly, but that's their strategy. I mean, they, unlike Israel and Gaza, Russia's actually taken great pains not to destroy civilian infrastructure and kill civilians, and so they have slowly but surely gained regions in eastern Ukraine, and they have whittled away at the Ukrainian army to the point where, frankly, you know, as we know, Ukraine's been forced to now conscript people off the street, elderly people and disabled people, because they have no one else left to fight. And, you know, they're always on the verge of being out of munitions as well. Even the West, NATO's running out of munitions because of this war. Russia, I think, is, it could be said to be handily winning this war. It could win it overnight if it wanted to. Again, if it wanted to carpet bomb Kiev, like, again, the U.S. and NATO are willing to carpet bomb, you know, Serbia or whatever, they could do that, but they don't.
You know, Dan, but it's really interesting is that Zelensky, you know, he's a jet setter. He gets to fly all over the place to these fancy conferences. But the airport is still open in Kiev, has been during the entire conflict. It hasn't been bombed, okay? This is something that's never pointed out. You know, David, what's really interesting, if, again, mentioning the Munich Security Conference, is that according to Zelensky, they're facing challenges because of Republicans in the House of Representatives. Does that wash with you?
No, it doesn't. Certainly, it's the U.S. that's primarily responsible for prolonging this war. There was, of course, the Istanbul Peace Agreement, which was 90% complete, as President Putin outlined during his Tucker Carlson interview. And then it was, you know, this was a very favorable agreement towards towards Ukraine. It would have entailed the entire withdrawal of Russian forces outside of the Donbas and Crimea. Crimea, of course, really was always Russian, but the Donbas was much disputed. You know, this was actually, you know, really the ideal argument. This is kind of the peace agreement, essentially, that I would argue that Biden's trying to get back to, but he foolishly rejected. So he torpedoed that. Prior to that, you know, it was the Minsk agreements that was really an ideal that for Ukraine that Putin was championing. And now, of course, it's an armistice agreement. It's an armistice agreement that I called for back in September of 2022 in the National Interest and on my own Real War Substack. And, you know, that is really the key. That is the key to, you know, a peace, in essence, without victors. You know, Ukraine can spin it as a victory. NATO can spin it a victory. Of course, it's more of a victory for Russia overall. But it would be 18% of Ukraine's internationally recognized territory. And neutrality outside of NATO. And those would be the two main terms. And most of those terms are, you know, obviously neutrality outside of NATO was something that Zelensky belatedly agreed to the day after the invasion. So, you know, it's all a matter of coming back to common sense and establishing peace and stability for the region.
Unfortunately, we're not there yet. We won't be for a long time. You know, Carl, what we have here is that I don't know. We've had over the last few weeks individual countries like Germany, France, the UK signing security agreements with Ukraine. I don't know why they're doing it in the middle of a conflict. I don't know what Ukraine that they're actually talking about. And this is, you know, and on top of it, instead of trying to secure as much funding as they can from the West, nobody is talking peace, at least in the West. Nobody in NATO is talking peace. That is the biggest problem here.
Exactly. I mean, the problem is not funding. The United States can print money up to the wazoos. But the problem is U.S. and to a certain extent Europe has been so deindustrialized that they cannot even provide artillery shells for Ukraine. You know, United States have over altogether near $1 trillion in military budget, and yet they can't even produce common military goods that are needed to win wars, as like artillery shells. Russia alone is outproducing the entire NATO country combined right now. Ukraine is, I mean, any objective observer of the conflict will tell you Ukraine is losing the war, its morale is collapsing, its manpower is being depleted. Now they're talking about sending refugee Ukrainian men from back from Europe to be drafted, and they're talking about conscripting women. I mean, how could the Ukraine win? There's no path for victory for Ukraine at this point.
Well, I mean, but they seem to think the people in NATO world think that, you know, $60 billion they're just around the corner. I cannot conceive, Dan. Real quick, I can't even if they got the money, what are they going to do with it, Dan?
Yeah, again, they don't have the troops anymore, and the morale is sinking. I mean, I think honestly, this war will be over. I'm predicting by the end of the summer, whether they send the $60 billion or they don't.
Well, yeah, I mean, but and of course, this is supposed to be money that will go into potentially the next administration. So they won't. It seems to me the arms dealers and all the cutouts, the NGOs, they want a secured funding into 2025. They think that's what it seems more about. Always, gentlemen, it's never really about Ukraine, is it? It's all about the money. It's all about the grip. All right, gentlemen, I'm going to jump in here. We're going to go to a short break. And after that short break, we'll continue our discussion on Ukraine. Stay with RT. Okay, let's go back to David in Salt Lake City. Let's go to the third proposition, how the war will end. Well, it's really difficult to grapple with this one because if you look at the official narrative, Russia lost half a year ago, but they're still looking for money to keep Ukraine propped up. I mean, they can't even get that talking point straight. Okay? Russia's already lost. Ukraine is winning. I mean, and you know, with all this social media right now, these Telegram channels here, it's really hard. I mean, if you have even a passing interest in the topic, it's quite obvious the official narrative is null and void. David.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. I mean, Ukraine has lost nearly 30% of its GDP. They've lost 27% of its population, 18% of its territory. They've lost, according to the most reasonable and moderate estimates, 500,000 troops, dead or seriously wounded, which is about three times higher than what Russia's lost. They don't occupy a single square inch of Russian territory. I mean, there's literally no metric that NATO could use to judge that Ukraine is winning the war, and yet we continue to hear this nonsense. I mean, Zelensky recently stated that the Ukrainian military consists of 600,000 active duty troops. Until recently, it was 1.3 million. So it could the casualties actually could be over 50%. It could be 700,000 Ukrainians killed or seriously wounded. So this has been a disaster for Ukraine. I'm preparing to write a new article on that. It's nearly completed. But it should be common knowledge to any unbiased observer that this has been a disaster. This whole Ukraine NATO membership pursuit has been really just irrational. It's been absolutely against the interests of Ukraine and very much so against the U.S. national security interests as well, which is peace with Russia. And we ought to be have a strategic partnership with Russia along the lines of what was proposed in December by the Russian Federation with their mutual security agreement with NATO, which was which was absolutely acceptable as written, and as well as the one that was offered to the U.S., which was 75% acceptable.
Yeah, and Carl, what they did, because for Russia, it has been NATO expansion, and even the head of NATO, Stoltenberg, he admitted this finally, belatedly. He wouldn't say it, honestly, for the good part of the conflict, but he came out, and maybe it was unintentional on his part, we don't know, but he even admitted that Russia started its military operations because of NATO expansion. So what do? They expand NATO. You've already mentioned Tucker Carlson's interview with Vladimir Putin. And again, he was asked point blank, would you like to see a ceasefire? Would you like to see an end of this conflict? And the Russian president said, yes, again. Okay, I mean, I don't know what else you can do. I mean, the most watched interview in the world, if you have a passing interest in this, you know what Russia's position is because it came from the president's mouth himself. But that, of course, was ignored. Carl.
Exactly. I mean, right now it's the security elite in Washington and Europe that's driving the war. You know, we know what happened during the negotiation to the early phase of negotiation to the end of the war. And Boris Johnson comes in and tells Ukraine, no, we will back you 100%. And right now, even if the West do back Ukraine 100%, and Ukraine still cannot achieve victory, as I said earlier, United States has been so deindustrialized, it cannot provide Ukraine with the ammunition it needs, with the artillery shell it needs. The U.S. can keep print money, but after a certain point, they're just paper. You can send $60 billion worth of paper to Ukraine. That's not going to help Ukraine win the war.
Carl, it ends up mostly coming back to the suburbs in Virginia, okay, at the end of the day. I mean, it's a grift. It's a huge grift. And I think that's why a lot of these people are pushing the $60 billions, because they know it's the last time they're going to be able to feed at the trough, okay? So they want to get paid in advance, okay? Is this cynical? Yeah, but this whole idea, this whole conflict is so cynical. It's the most avoidable conflict in my lifetime. And I've seen a lot of conflicts. You know, Dan, what's really interesting, if we can throw in the Gaza dimension here and look at this globally, is that you have the West on the wrong side of issues, okay? You have the United States and Europe supporting a racist regime in Kiev, a racist regime in Israel. And the whole world can see this. Dan.
No, it's absolutely right. I was listening to George Galloway this morning, and he said, you know, the West, the sun is now setting in the West, and it is now rising in the East, which is very clear. As you say, the whole world sees the difference in how Russia prosecutes this war in Ukraine and how Israel prosecutes the war in Gaza. I think the statistic I saw was that about less than 600 children have died in the special military operations in Ukraine. Meanwhile, you already have something like 15,000 children who've died in Gaza, and intentionally so. It's a brutal, brutal campaign that's happening in Gaza in a very short period of time, we also have to, you know, recognize, as opposed to, you know, we're now, what, 2 years into the conflict in Ukraine, if we started from the beginning, the special military operation. So, yes, it's very clear that moral superiority the West could ever claim, and that was always a dubious proposition, it can't claim it anymore.
You know, David, I had a look at Zelensky's speech in Munich, and it would be hilarious if it weren't so pathetic, is that he was using talking points from the Secretary of State Blinken, you know, the rules-based order. And I just thought, you have no freedom of speech in your country. Opposition political parties are banned. You have this news telethon on propagandizing. No one can leave your country. I mean, what rules-based order is he talking about? Maybe the same rules-based order that Blinken thinks when he thinks of Gaza. I don't know. David, what do you think?
Yeah, I agree. I think so. The rules-based order, you know, applies only to other countries. It doesn't apply to the U.S. The U.S., you know, bombs and invades countries at will. And I'm saying this as a patriotic American. I love America. I think there's still hope for us to get back on track, establish peace with Russia, and do so in a in a way that's fair and just. But, you know, I mean, examples have already been given during this this conversation with, you know, the NATO bombing of Serbia, Libya, of course, the U.S. Invasions of Iraq, Afghanistan, which was partially justified, Iraq, which was not, and then Syria as well. So, you know, we have a lot of examples of the U.S. behaving badly as a bully, an international bully, and doing so unprovoked and unjustified. In the case of Ukraine, yes, it was an illegal invasion, but it was very much provoked. It couldn't have been more provoked. And Putin, you know, worked and strove for a peaceful diplomatic solution for at least 14, perhaps 15 years prior to the war, and it couldn't have been more clear, beginning with his speech at the Munich Security Conference in 2007. Yeah. So responding to Bush's threat to add Ukraine and Georgia into NATO. And it was, you know, I mean, again, doing so was completely against the U.S. national security interests, but it was all about expanding America's liberal empire, as Senator Josh Hawley rightly calls it, trying to expand our sphere of influence right up to Russia's entire western frontier. And that would be unacceptable from, if you know, we need to have more strategic empathy with Russia. If
it's really interesting. People like ourselves, our patriotism is questioned. You know, okay, I am a conservative, and I think foreign wars, foreign interventions, is not a conservative idea. Okay, it's these liberal elites. Okay, it's really interesting. People like Victoria Nuland, she can float between Republican and Democrats quite easily because she's a neocon. Okay, they have their own set of values, and it's not the rules. Based order that I would understand as a conservative. You know, Carl, it's I've always thought that this ridiculous expansion of NATO was to undermine Russia, obviously, to throw it out of completely out of Europe. The sanctions I am actually for because it's helped Russia's economy. And the Soviet Union was our target anyway. OK, so Russia knows how to adapt here. But the real aim, of course, is to challenge China. And so their ridiculous childlike calculation was we knock out Russia, then we take on China. I mean, with that kind of calculus, I thought, you know, they were the adults in the room. Carl.
No, there's no adults in the room. The people in Washington, all they care about is short-term self-interest, which is continue to feed the trough at the military-industrial complex. I mean, even Assange has pointed out back in 2011, he said the goal is to use Afghanistan to wash money out of the tax base of the U.S. and Europe through Afghanistan and back into the hands of transnational security elite. The goal is an endless war, not a successful war. So this goes back to what you're saying about grift. You know, they at this point, they probably don't even care if they win in Ukraine, as long as they can keep fuel the proxy war against Russia to quote unquote bleed Russia at the same time to feed the military industrial complex back at home.
Yeah, you know, Dan, thinking about ending this, this is what is really kind of problematic because it's already been mentioned on this program, the Minsk process, which the West was deceitful about. We had Istanbul, again, deceit. I don't see any kind of real agreement to end it. It will end on Russia's terms at the end of the day because you can't make an agreement with these people. They lie and they break their agreements. They even are open about it. Dan.
Yeah, well, it's all very true. And also we have to remember that this could have been ended in March of 2022 with an agreement that Zelensky was willing to sign and which would have allowed Ukraine to keep all its territory.
No, Dan, let me add to that. Okay. They were asking Zelensky to agree to something that he didn't even have anymore, the Donbass. They were just saying you have to give up the Donbass and Crimea, something Ukraine didn't even have at the time. That's how good of a deal it was, Dan.
It was a good deal, and the U.S. and U.K. intervened to stop that agreement from going forward. Essentially, Russia was offering a do-over for the West, and they didn't take it. And now Ukraine will not exist as it has. It will. They will not get at least the four republics that have voted to go with Russia. They will never get those back. And that is firmly on the heads of the leaders of the U.S.
Well,
and the
I think, ending the program, that's going to have to rename the country Benderistan, okay? Because it's going to be the European Union that is going to have to take care of it. It's going to be a ward. It'll be a state lit that'll have to be supported. All right, gentlemen, that's all the time we have. I want to thank my guests in Bali, Pittsburgh, and in Salt Lake City. And of course, I want to thank our viewers for watching us here at RT. See you next time, and remember, Crosstalk Rules.